welcome everyone. We're back with Life in the Peloton. I'm three quarters of the way through this Vuelta España, and I've been lucky enough to sit down with my teammate Hugh Carfi. I want to welcome Lionel Burney back to the podcast as well. G'day mate, how are you doing there?
I'm good, thanks, Mitch, and I'm really looking forward to this one. Just before we hear your conversation with Hugh, Mitch, just paint the scene for us. Where were you chatting? What's the hotel been like today?
We were chatting in my hotel room where I am recording this right now. Beautiful little hotel here. We're over in Galicia now and getting ready for the stages over here. We've got the time trial tomorrow. It was actually quite a wet morning this morning, so we all jumped on the trainers and did our little blowout session on the rest day, but actually it fined up in the afternoon, and I went across the other side of the hotel and got my massage over there, and it was this beautiful big glass window in my massage therapist's room, and we looked out over the coast, the rolling waves crashing against the shores, and we watched the big tankers go past, and one of the best massage views I've had. And my masseur John said, "How much would you be paying for this normally?" And I couldn't put a figure on it, but it felt like I was in a luxurious hotel, away on some retreat getting a massage, let alone I was brought back to reality when I came back to my room and opened up the page for the week coming ahead. So that was what happened today. I'm in a happy mood. I've got a time trial tomorrow, but then I break it down to four hard stages and then the time to roll into Madrid after that. Before we get into it, I just have to make a special mention of the way Hugh is riding here. He's really stepped up and he's really opened up. And when I spoke to him last week on Talking Luft over at Life in the Peloton's feed, it was great. It gave me this idea, oh, I'm really going to get him for the big podcast over at the Cycling Podcast. So I slipped it in there. I didn't tell him. I let him hear it on the podcast. And then he came to me in the bus and said, "Am I doing the podcast next week as well?" I said, "You sure are, mate." So he stepped it up. He won the Angrelou stage. I said, "Well done, mate. That's great work. Now we can got something to talk about on the podcast." So without further ado, sit back and listen to this one. We've got a lot of questions coming in. I want to say thanks to everyone who sent all their questions in. Obviously, we couldn't get through them. It's the most questions we've ever got for a pod. So that was amazing. And all the congratulations to Hugh too. So they were fantastic. So guys, enjoy this one. Welcome to the podcast, Hugh Carfi. You're back again in another week. So I cheekily got you last week on Talking Luft.
Yeah.
Then presented the idea to the whole audience that you were coming back the next week. I didn't tell
Without
you.
Without telling me.
Exactly.
Yeah, you pulled the cheeky bastard card on me, but I'll forgive you.
But I knew potentially something good might happen in the next week. I was unaware that you would be at the top of Angrelou first, which was yesterday. So I'm bloody happy to have you back on the pod, mate. Thank you for coming back.
My pleasure.
That's Hugh Carfi. For anyone who didn't hear the Talking Luft, go back and have a listen to that. That's over on my feed, Life in the Peloton. Before we get started, well, actually, as we're getting started, I've got to go straight to it. We're less than 24 hours from the stage win, and I know a lot of people are wanting to hear about it. Let's just go straight to that. Let's just go straight to Angrelou. The Queen Stage, wow, equal Queen Stage in this race. Saturday and Sunday were very hard days, but Angrelou is the mountain in Spain. We were discussing this before the race. What are the five hardest mountains in the world? And Angrelou, we think, is on the podium, if not atop of that podium. Run me through what you thought about coming into this stage. When we're sitting in the bus yesterday, sort of bantering away about the stage, your feelings, because even from speaking to you from that last podcast, we indicated a few little things, talking to me on the mountain, little things you've said along the way. Your legs are being good in this race. So you run me through coming into yesterday's stage. How are you feeling?
Yeah, again, another day where you wake up and you jump out of bed and you just feel right. You know, some days when you're not going well, you don't sleep well, or you get up and your back's hurting, or you just... things just go wrong, you know. You're pouring your milk on your cereal and you overflow the bowl, you're not concentrating. But the past couple of weeks, everything's just gone nicely, you know. Everything just felt right on and off the bike. I've been getting up in the morning full of energy, and you just know. I like, for me, a lot of riders don't like walking upstairs, and I agree with that, you don't walk upstairs. But for me, I like to walk down the stairs. you can feel your legs, you know, especially on your quads and your thighs. You feel your legs. If you've had a hard day or your body's not quite 100%, it's really, really painful. But the past couple of weeks, I've been trotting down the stairs to breakfast or trotting down after the stage, and I've been hearing other people wincing, oh, legs are tired, and I've been just sort of floating Harry Potter style down the stairs on my broomstick, without sounding arrogant, but yeah, I've known this whole race that my legs have been good. I've been recovering well, sleeping well, eating well. The atmosphere in the team's been good, which gives you an extra gear. So yeah, everything's been spot on for me so far.
Yeah, and that's the sort of feeling you want coming into such a stage yesterday. You know, with two Cat 3s, two Cat 2s, and then the Angaroo. How do you pronounce it?
Angaroo.
Angaroo, sorry. Not kangaroo, as I like to call it.
Angaroo, whatever you call it. Angaroo.
The Angaroo. So, to not feel that fear of it, not fearing a mountain, I think that'd be an amazing feeling coming to this and just be like, all right, I'm just going to give it what I've got because I'm not scared of it. And is that the feeling you had coming to that hill yesterday?
Yeah, but stage 11, I was a little bit apprehensive, despite what I just said a minute ago about feeling great. I was a little bit apprehensive. I felt good, but that was sort of a killer stage, you know what I mean? I've been in days like that before where you start off well and then a team like Movistar or Ineos put a hard rhythm on a climb, and next thing you're uncomfortable and your head goes and you think, oh well, it's over. So I was a little bit nervous going to that stage. I felt good at the start and I rode well through, and I felt great at the end, and I lost a few seconds at the finish. I had a couple of messages from people at home saying exactly what I was thinking when I crossed the line, and I knew there was a gap, and I thought, oh bloody hell, I've lost a few seconds, but I felt great. It was just it was a headwind climb. It was a negative sort of climb, negative sort of race. No one really wanted to show the cards. And I think maybe people on TV saw it and thought, oh, he lost a few seconds, he's not so great. But I knew, and the people, my family and a few friends that I train with at home, and they know me inside out, they knew exactly the scenario. They said, we saw you were great. We saw you were floating on that climb. You could see it in your face. You could see it in your legs. You were fresh. You're going to be great tomorrow. And I knew it myself. I said, I don't read too much into that result. Well, it's easy to sit here now and say it on the podcast, but I don't think I expected to win. I never expect to win. No rider is arrogant enough to expect to win. But I was apprehensive going into stage 11, but I was confident that I was good in stage 12, barring any bad luck or bad fortune, whatever. I knew I'd be there at the end. Winning, I don't know. Winning your local crit in your hometown is difficult. Do you know what I mean? To win any race is difficult, local or on the world stage. But if I'd been in the top five yesterday, maintained my fourth on GC, put time to some people behind, maybe gained time, moved up a spot, I'd have been thrilled with that. But to win, yeah, it was. It's hard to describe. I mean, people think I'm a man of few words. You know, they see my interviews, I don't give much away, and think, oh, he's a he's real, I don't know what the word is, sort of...
Shy,
he doesn't get involved. But my teammates know I'm pretty hard to shut up.
Yeah, it's quite the opposite, I can tell you.
It's hard to shut me up once I get going. But yesterday, the finish, I was, and I'm sort of diverting from the question, but sort of rambling now, but I was...
Lost for words.
Yeah. It happened last year when I won in Tour de Suisse. It's a strange feeling. A year like this, not any year, but especially this year, where you go through so much uncertainty. And cycling as a career, it's not like football where you're 20 and you get a 7-year contract with Man United or Man City, and you're earning 100 grand a week, and you think 100 grand a week for a year, save up, and then I'm set for life. You know what I mean? In our job, you can earn good money and you can have a nice career, but it's not the same league as other sports. You always got that kind of fear of the future in your mind. You think what am I going to do if I don't get a next contract? What am I going to do? And I've said it before, and it's quite a common answer, quite a common feeling. You just feel relieved when you win. You feel relief for me, my family, the team. You think, I've given the team, I think every team at the moment is looking for a way forward through the crisis that we're in. Some teams more than others, but our team needs every victory counts at this point. It's not like we're hanging on by any means, but you think, I really hope my victory has played a part in the future of the team. and other people, the people like yourself, who, you're not a team leader, you're the guy that has to put me in the right position before a climb, or drag me across in a crosswind, or drag me across a gap, or make a gap. The victories are for you as well. These victories keep you in a job, you know what I mean? They keep the guys that you don't see winning. It's relief for everyone, I think. You know what I mean?
I think you put a few points there, really good points, is that there comes a time in your career that you've got to capitalize on everything you've built up.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like over your career, you've been building, and last year in Swiss and even some other results before then, it's time to capitalize on it. And sometimes you see these riders who get to that point, they don't quite capitalize on that form, and they just don't get those victories. And they sort of fade away, and they never really get that contract or that accolations I think they deserve. An amazing thing with you is that it's happening, and you're realizing it in the moment. You're like, I've got to make most of these chances. And then on the other side of that, I think this is great too, is that people really, it's the victory's not just for you.
No.
And it's about a lot of people into the support. It's not just me. It's not just the family. It's everyone around it. It's the team. It's everyone. And so you feel that. You feel that in the success too, I can imagine.
Yep.
I want to cut straight now to 2K to go.
Yep.
Because as anyone, well, not everyone might know this, but the climb is 12K. We come directly off of Cat 1, 5K Cat 1, straight into the bottom of the Angrelou. And then it's pretty
tame.
Tame at the start. When I say tame, it's about 8%, between 8 and...
That would normally be Cat 1 gradient.
Yeah. But it feels okay. And then you get this 1K little respite, flat. It was beautiful.
Yep.
And then at about 6.5K to go, it kicks.
Yep.
And it really does kick straight away. But it doesn't kick yet. It sort of just thins everything out. Run me through the first part when it kicks at 6K to go, but then especially tell me about the hell kilometer at 2K to go.
Yeah, so 6K to go, that's where the sort of the real climb starts. And for me, I can relax then. For me, the bits that I don't like in the stage are the downhills, and you think, oh, things can happen here, or the flat bits, the possible split or whatever. So when I arrive at any climb, the final climb, mountaintop finish, I hold the doubt and fear, whatever, bang, out. You throw it out, and all you have to do is just use your legs and not panic and stuff. That's that. So when I got to the climb, first and foremost, that was sort of, for me, job done. I was like, I'm here, this is going to be great. My legs are good, nothing can go wrong in a way. So we get to 6K to go, I think, right, this is it now.
Nothing technically can go wrong.
No, it's just
down to physical now.
Yeah, it's just physical. Yeah. I mean, you got bad luck, obviously, but that's bad luck. So then when I get to 6K to go, the climb really starts. And I thought, well, we've got the low gears on the bikes, so I'm going to be fine.
What were you feeling at that moment? Were you comfortable?
I was feeling good. The group was small by then, maybe 15 riders. I don't know, 15 or so riders. I still had Mike Woods with me, which is, even though he was sat behind me, I think having someone sat behind you in pink as a teammate, whatever colour, pink in our case, it's less having someone's hand on your back. So you have like a bodyguard. They can, if someone wants to try and get on your wheel to try and come past you, they can sort of...
It's a bit safe. Yeah,
You feel safe. You feel secure. So it's another weight off your mind. You can just focus on your legs. Again, we get closer up the climb. Then I start seeing people throwing out bottles. It was quite a warm day yesterday for the 1st of November in the north of Spain. And I still had a little bit left in my bottle. So I thought, I thought I've got an advantage here. I'm kind of tiny, a bit of extra weight. But 6K, 5K... in these gradients, that's still half an hour of climbing.
I would think so.
That's a long time without a drink in my eyes. So I thought, well, I'm gaining an advantage here with this. And if they're throwing them out with such a long way to go, then maybe they're desperate for that extra little advantage. So I carried on.
Psychological games coming in. I like it.
Yeah, so we get to 5K to go, and I'd save one last gel for 5K to go. I didn't really need it, but I had it, and I thought, I'll take it. 5K to go, I'll take it. 5K to go, took the gel. I responsibly dispose of the wrapper. And again, we carry on. And then 4K to go, I can't really remember what was happening. It was just Lotto Jumbo or Jumbo Visma. They were riding their tempo. They had two guys left with Roglic. Carapaz was on his own. Enric Mas was on his own by this point. Dan Martin on his own. And I still had Woodsy behind. So,
were you comfortable at this pace, or was it starting to hurt now?
No, it wasn't hurting. It really wasn't hurting. I think it was hurting, but I was so focused. and feeling so good that it wasn't.
Yeah, you weren't like, oh, I don't know if I can hang on one more K. You were just like
that. I knew that if they carried on like that, I'd have made it to the top easy.
Yeah.
Not easy, no, but comfortably.
Yeah.
Within my limit. So I was never panicking. Then I think 3K to go, Enrique Mas went. When you say go, you never really attack on a climb like that. You just lifted his own pace and got a gap. So I thought, okay, I'm feeling good. I'm going to lift my pace and just up my pace ever so slightly. Not try and reel him in and get in his wheel. Just hold the pace slightly higher, see what happens behind. And then at that point...
Because, sorry to interrupt, I don't know if you're thinking this, but to a degree, there's no real advantage about sitting in someone else's wheel at that point.
Absolutely
at those gradients.
The only thing is you have like a carrot in front of you and you stick with someone, you can hold their rhythm. That's the only thing. But aerodynamically, there's no real advantage. So Enrique Mas went, I followed him, I raised my tempo. And at that point, normally Roglic and Carapaz are pretty quick to react to things. And they didn't react at that point, so I thought, this is maybe something. So then I thought, okay, well, I'm not going to try and get Enrique Mas back because I think he's quite a passionate rider. He does something, he races in a way sometimes where he can be quite courageous and then he blows. I've done it before. I did it on stage 7 or 8 in Logroño, that area.
Were you thinking this at the time or is this in hindsight now?
No, this is at the time. I was thinking, okay, just hold my rhythm. I remember what Juanma said in the morning, the director said in the morning, nobody attacks on that climb. You can't attack, you just got to ride your own pace. If you got extra gas, lift your rhythm. Don't attack. Just don't go into the red because you'll never recover. So I had that in the back of my mind, so I thought, okay, don't try and chase him back. Normally on a flatter climb, an easier climb, you make an extra effort to get into someone's wheel to use their slipstream. But in this case, I was thinking, no, don't make that extra effort to get to him. Just stay here, trust that he's going to blow or whatever, he's going to come back or the others. At that point, the others behind Roglic and Carapaz, Dan Martin, and I think Vlasov was there from Astana, they came back to us, and then Carapaz went. Maybe Enrique Mas went again, I can't remember. Then it was just the three of us at that point. We gapped Roglic, Dan Martin, then I thought, okay, those guys have got a punch. If they could have followed, they would have followed. At that point, I thought, okay, and I was feeling good.
This is like 2K to go, isn't it?
Yeah, more or less 2K to go. And at this point, we're going slowly, and then we're sort of riding 3 abreast almost across the road. And I thought, well, it's not far now. It's about 3 minutes until my finish line. The top, when you get to the KOM line, it's downhill all the way. If I get there with a few seconds, a small gap, that gap will
open up.
It'll be like an accordion. It'll open right up when you start going at 30-40 k an hour in the flat section. And I was feeling comfortable. I thought, okay, I've got to go. So I went. I looked around on one of the hairpins. I had a nice little gap. And I thought, well, at least we're doing 10k an hour. I thought, a nice little gap at 10k an hour is a big gap.
Yeah,
if you're doing 25k an hour on a normal 6, 7% climb, that'll be 50, 60, 70 meters. So I thought, this is it. I'm going to... All I have to do is get to the top, and then I put it in the big chain ring. It flattened out slightly.
What, it went down to like 14%, did it?
A little bit lower, I think it was 10% or something. So I put it in the big chain ring and really gave it some on that. The faster section, trying to open, then I come round the corner again, I think, oh shit, and I can see the road kicking up again to 20%. So I had to go down to the small dog again. Spin up the last bit, just really, oh, it must have looked terrible on TV, but I was giving it. I was suffering then. I thought it's sort of do or die. This is it now. This is it. You've made your decision to go.
Do it.
You've either got to do it now or it's never going to happen.
Yeah.
But like I said, I think when I went, if they could have followed me, they would. So I was in the back of my mind thinking, they're going to have to make some effort to bring this gap back. Then I passed the KOM point. I was still a little behind. Juanma was telling me on the radio I had a good gap, 20 seconds something to Carapaz and Enrique Mas. Then I got to about 500 metres to go and I looked round because the road was kind of exposed behind so you could see, and they weren't even in sight. So I thought,
there's just no way.
They were 400 or 500 metres behind me at that point, maybe a little bit less, but I still couldn't see them, so they were along, like I said, the accordion effect on that climb. It looked like they could have touched me physically, but on the steep bit, but when you go onto the flat bit, the gap was huge. So then that was it. I just I still carried on going, but I just enjoyed it. The last 500 metres, I caught my breath, got goosebumps, and just enjoyed it.
Yeah.
Got the arms up and enjoyed it.
Mate, that's brilliant. I had to go back and watch it last night on the bus. I heard the whole thing in the radio as I was 6-7K down the road, but it's amazing to see that, just to hear the emotion behind it. It was a great day, mate. It was a fantastic day. What I want to do is I want to go back a little notch now. And in case anyone doesn't know a little bit about you, I just want to talk quickly about where you've come from.
Mm-hmm.
You're from Preston in Lancashire.
Yep.
You started off there. You ended up riding on Rafa Condor JLT. Then you went across to Spain and rode for Caja Rural. After Caja Rural, you came on to Cannondale, which is now EF.
Yep.
I've got some questions that have been sent in, which are a few questions about this period, because I did want you to talk a little bit about this period, about coming through, but I thought, why not now go into some Q&A, and we can talk about some of these questions as well.
Let's go.
So, Anton and Ahmed, they sent in a question in saying, what was it like learning the ropes at Caja Rural? Is it quite different from the usual path?
I don't know. It's the only path I took, so I don't know what the other path is, but for me it was a baptism of fire. It wasn't easy at first, integrating, learning the language, but after a couple of months it was great. The team accepted me, everyone saw that I had ability, and they saw that I'd made the effort that I made to learn the language and integrate. Everyone appreciated that. And yeah, it was a really great 2 years. I would not change that part of my career for the world. I honestly wouldn't.
I have a second question on that, and this is something that I think is a great part about not starting in a normal, let's say, Australian Institute of Sport or the British Academy,
mm-hmm.
is that you get more worldly. And now when you're in the peloton, you've got your own mates, Spanish mates. You've got a connection with Movistar. You've got a connection with the Caja Rural guys, whoever it is. You've been on team with some of these guys. You've trained with guys living in Pamplona.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, you've got all your old mates from the UK. Do you see that as a big advantage now, being a pro, and whether they're mates or whether they're not mates, you can communicate with a lot more guys, you have a lot more respect in the peloton because you've come through a different way?
Yeah, I think the language is the biggest thing. I think less so now, because 90% of the peloton speak English. But I think being able to speak a language is a tool of the trade. You know, if you're in a breakaway with someone and you want to have a sneaky, quiet word with another guy, form a little bond and attack together or something, you can do it without everyone knowing. I think it's just good to know different people, know the few directors that speak Spanish or things or whatever. If you speak Italian, the same thing, you can speak with Italian directors or Italian riders and stuff. And it can definitely help you in the races. It's not just about being friends or having people to talk to. It definitely can be a tool of the trade to use and use to good effect. But yeah, it's nice, especially now. Even before I came to this race a few weeks ago at home, I said, oh yeah, it'd be nice to go to the Vuelta. It's where Spain's where my career really, really started. I've got a lot of fans in Spain, but there are a lot of people that, especially in the north of Spain, that's
a second home.
Yeah, they look out for me and they support me for a long time. So I love it. Even in the hotels, you can see when I get excited being in the Spanish hotels. Even it's just ordering the coffees and the treatment we get and stuff. And it's nice just to be able to. I love it. I love being back in Spain. I love being, you know, speaking with the staff and the hotels and the fans and stuff. I think that, yeah, the Spanish fans and things, it's the real, more so than in the country, the more connoisseurs. You know what I mean? The connoisseurs of cycling. You know, they don't just follow the Spanish riders. In France, a lot of the time, they just follow the French riders. In Italy, they just follow the Italian riders. But in Spain, they follow everyone. They don't care if you're Australian, British, Canadian, Spanish, Italian, or Japanese, South African. They don't care. They support. If you're a bike racer, you got a number on your back, they'll support you and they'll know you. There's a lot of times you're out the arse of the race in the gruppetto, and they know.
A lot of times you're out the arse in the back.
We've had this argument before. I've done my time in the groupette over the years.
Okay.
Don't think for 1 minute I've been in the front group on grand tours. I've suffered through a few grand tours in my time. But yeah, you're out the arse there, and not my name, but you hear like random guys that you wouldn't even expect, and the fans are shouting them, giving them a little push, pat on the back, giving them a can of Coke or something, shouting the name. I honestly believe that the Spanish fans are up there. Cycling fans are the best there are.
Mm.
Really are the best there are. There's another point where I don't want to bring Corona into it, I really don't, but a part of me would have felt terrible this year if the Vuelta hadn't happened. Because in my eyes, out of all the Grand Tours for the fans, I feel like the Spanish fans deserve the Vuelta more than any other country. I mean, cycling without the Tour, it wouldn't be half as big as it is. And the Giro, the same story. But even though the Vuelta is probably the smallest of the three Grand Tours, if we're being
honest
and factual, it's probably the smallest of the three Grand Tours. But it would have felt, I'd be the most disappointed if the Vuelta hadn't come off.
Mm.
Because I think the fans in Spain really, really, really appreciate, even the ones that don't really follow cycling, it would have been a shame, Matt. So I'm happy we're here with the second rest day. So far, so good. Touch wood. Look what we've got. We've got like in the Giro and the Tour, we've got coming into a TT with the race tight as a
screw. One question here. A few people asked, which part of the mountain hurt the most?
Yesterday?
Yeah.
I think the beginning sometimes hurts the most because you come off a descent straight into the climb, your legs are your legs kind of turn to stone a little bit on the descent, and you got to sort of find your legs again. But once you find your legs and they come back, it's okay then.
Steve was asking, was it always planned, the final attack on Angrelou?
If I had the good legs and I was in the right position, yeah, that was planned. We knew that with around a K to go, it got easier. It was downhill all the way. Whoever got to the top first won. The KOM point, whoever got to the KOM point first would probably win, unless it was a group, like a small group.
Unless someone was in your wheel.
If you were solo at that KOM point, you were going to win the stage. Even with 5 second gap, you were going to win the stage.
Mm.
So, yeah. There was factors that depended on me attacking at that point. If I hadn't been great and I hadn't had the legs, I probably wouldn't have been able to attack or be able to launch my final move. But the legs were there, the group was reduced enough, there were people hanging on, so I thought, yeah, this is going this is dream scenario. This is, we talk a lot about the dream scenarios in the bus. Okay, well, we're going to attack here, we're going to do this, we do that. And being honest, it rarely works out like that. It's not a PlayStation game. But yesterday it couldn't have worked out any better. The group was right. I was feeling great. The moment was there, and it all worked out sweetly.
Perfect. What was your gearing on stage 12? The gearing ratio. This is from Night Roulette.
So we had, on the front chain rings, we had a 34 small chain ring and a 53 big chain ring.
I thought you had a 52.
No, 53. It's quite a rare combination. FSA have made us some special 53 chain rings, but for the small 110 size spider. Mm. Normally with 110, I think you only go up to 52 normally, I think.
That's what I thought.
If you were going to buy them, but I think we have some special 53 ones made. And then behind, I had an 11-32 cassette. So my lowest gear was 34 at the front, 32 at the back. Biggest gear 53-11, the standard.
Did you use that?
I did use it.
Yeah,
I did use it a lot, and there were times where I was using it and I was still grinding.
Yeah,
if you want to know how hard
the climb is.
And that was I don't know how many watts, but six watts per kilo, 6.5 watts per kilo on some of those really steep ramps where you just had to go full gas,
and you're still grinding
in 34-32.
This is from Liam. Are there any climbs that compare to the Angrelou? Motorolo, which is harder?
Angrelou is harder. Motorolo is constant. It's hard, but it's not as steep. The Motorolo road surface isn't great, but I don't know. When I did the Motorolo last year, my legs were great, so the climb doesn't feel.
Well, we don't have the same gearing on it, do you?
Last year, I think we had 34 at the front. 30 at the back.
Oh, 30. What's the hardest climb then?
The hardest climb? I don't know. The hardest climb is always the one where you're getting spat on. You know what I mean?
I said Zonkerland.
Zonkerland's hard because that was a really steep climb. But I think the Angleroo's harder. It's different circumstances with different years. And I'm better now. I'm older, better. I'm going to have to say, I don't know. I did the Mortirolo one a similar day to yesterday with great legs. And I'd say that the Angleroo is harder than the Mortirolo.
I guess the thing is the Mortirolo, it's always going over it and onto something else.
Yeah, the Mortirolo, I've done it, I think, twice now, and every time it's always been either midway through a stage or at the end of a stage, but you've descended off it. And in some ways, the descent can be harder than the climb itself. The descent off the Mortirolo is it's a real horror show of a descent. It's steep, it's twisty, bad road, it's twisty. Slippy roads. So yeah,
what's going through your head? This is from JJ. What's going through your head?
As in
I don't know if it's JJ the mechanic. It could be.
Let's presume it is JJ the mechanic.
Yeah. What's going through your head when the bike breaks down? Are you thinking? No, that's not the question. What's going through your head on a gnarly mountain stage with GC or stage considerations at play? Are you primarily in the present and focus on what's going on around you and team tactics, or do you / can you take your mind elsewhere?
No, you always stay in the game. You stick to the plan until you get to a point where when you're a professional and you've got the director, nowadays with the director and the earpiece and the TVs in the cars, that sixth sense, you have it in the car as well. You have to make the decision yourself. Ultimately, you feel the pain, you feel the road and the way the race is, but you know what I mean? You just know. But you've got to stay calm. When you're feeling good, the worst thing you can do is get carried away. You got to wind it in, you know what I mean? Just think, okay, we stick to the plan and execute. When you execute the plan, you execute 100%. Don't execute it early and then the moment you run it too early or
have excuses afterwards. Yeah.
But at the same time, I don't know. It's a difficult one. I think it depends on the stage. It really does depend on the stage and it depends on the team you've got with you. If you've got a really strong team of climbers with you, I think you can be more daring. But if you're sort of on your own, I was with Woods yesterday, and so there's two of us, and we're both, Woods is really gone, to be honest. He finished ninth on the stage, ninth on one of the Queen stage, after he's been working for me for the past few days in the climbs. We were a real strong duo, but you've got to be careful. When you're on your own and you've only got one team with you, you've got to be careful. Because if it goes tits up, you can quickly be on the back foot chasing him without many resources.
Tell me this. This is from Matthew. How does someone from Preston, elevation of 266 meters, become the world's best climber?
Well, I'm gonna have to correct you, Matthew. Is it Matthew?
Yeah.
Preston is not 266 meters.
What is it?
I think it's around 50. It's below 50.
Where's he pulled 266 from?
I think maybe he's thinking of Preston in some. He's typed in Preston into somewhere, and or maybe his GPS watch is he's not calibrated it recently.
Regardless, a low place. Has it got anything to do with living in Andorra now?
No, I think I've always been a good climber, and I think, you know what I mean. You are what you are. I'm built for climbing. You look at me. I'm built for climbing.
Yeah.
It's as simple as that. It doesn't matter whether you're from altitude or from sea level. If you're built for climbing, you'll be good at climbing.
Look at guessing.
Exactly.
It's from Holland.
Yeah.
This is from Samir. What is the recovery period, training period between the Tour de France and the Vuelta look like for Hugh? Any specific training sessions to build back up? Because it was quite a funny year this year. You know, it was only, what was it, 4 weeks between the end of the Tour de France and the start of this?
Yeah.
So it was pretty tight.
Yeah.
What happened for you in that 4 weeks?
So the day after the Tour de France, I flew to Imola and to the World Championships, which was nice to do, but my head and my legs were ready for it. I picked up an injury in the Tour, my arm. I crashed on my arm and I was pretty downbeat about that, about this and that. And I still finished the Tour well. I rode well enough for the final week, doing what I could for the team. But I was ready for a bit of a break. I just wanted to get my arm right. At the time when I was told we might need you to the World Tour, we've not got many riders left at this point, I was thinking, bloody hell, I just want to
get on the beers.
No, not even that. Just want to get my arm right and just relax a bit. So I went to Imola. My arm still wasn't right, and I remember like halfway through the week, a few days before the World Championships, I tried to open a bottle of water on the table. And I'd been telling everyone my arm was getting better, and I tried to open it with my left arm, and I couldn't open this bottle of water because I couldn't grip tight enough. I remember a couple of people looking at me funny, thinking, should you really be here?
Yeah.
And I was like, no, I'm fine. And it was okay. It was my arm, on the bike, my arm was more or less okay at that point. A few days before the World Championships, the team sort of sprung it on me that the something had happened to one of the riders who was due to do Flesh for Loan, and I needed to fly to Belgium. So I was like, bloody hell. If I'd known I was going to have to go to Belgium, I wouldn't have done the World Championship. I'd have gone home for a week of rest. And so I was like, oh. And then I was tired at the World Championships. I flew to Belgium the night of the World Championships. So we arrived late that night in wherever it was, in somewhere in Belgium, Genk.
Yeah,
Genk, is that right?
Yeah, that's Genk, right.
In the Ardennes, or somewhere near there. Arrived there and I was just out of it. You know what I mean? I was just over it.
Yeah,
the Vuelta was still. I was thinking, if I'm doing the Vuelta, I don't really want to be. I just want to be at home, just resting. And I hadn't been at home since before the Dauphiné.
Oh my gosh.
We'd been a week before the Dauphiné. We went to the Dauphiné to sort of quarantine, stay in a safe zone. Post-Dauphiné, we went back to Andorra, but we stayed in a hotel. I wasn't allowed to go home. I wasn't allowed to see friends. We stayed in our own sort of reclusive bubble. And then we went straight to the tour, then to Imola, then to Flesh for Loan. So I was like, please let me go home for a week. And the team were understanding, but at the same time, I was understanding as well, because the whole calendar at that point was just, there was about four different calendars going on.
Mm.
And obviously with riders being injured, sick or whatever, they had to pull riders out of hats, you know what I mean? And just make people do things they didn't necessarily want or need to do.
So then what did you do from there? How long was it from there to the Vuelta? Well, 2 weeks?
Well, about 2 weeks-ish, about two and a half weeks. So anyway, after Belgium, I was cooked. I was completely cooked. I couldn't sleep properly. I had ulcers. I was drawn. I was bag under my eyes. But then I thought, okay, well, this is it. Just do the Vuelta and just sack it for the year.
So what did you do when you got home? Just rested?
Yeah, I rested for a few days. Then I got back on my bike and started training. And I felt okay. I thought, I actually feel okay here. I had a few nice days rest. I switched off. Had a couple of beers and relaxed a little bit with some friends, and I started to ride my bike, and I thought, I don't feel half bad here.
Mm.
I don't feel terrible anyway. I've picked up a lot in the past few days. And at that point, this was probably 10 days, a week or so before the Vuelta, a week, 10 days before the Vuelta, and I was doing some decent training rides, some long training rides and stuff, trying to get just keep the form going. I was still with an eye to the Vuelta, and Charlie Wagelius rang me while I was out of training, and he said, oh, we've got the all clear from the team to start the Vuelta with seven riders. So if you don't want to do it, you're still cooked. We know you're cooked. You don't have to do it. But if you do want to do it, there's no pressure on you.
There's a spot.
There's a spot there. If you want to take it, you can do. But if you don't, the team can start with seven riders. It's not an issue. You can pull it after 10 days. Get to the second rest day or something, and then
today
then put them today and stop and rest up and focus for next year. It's going to be a big year for you next year. You just rest up for that. But at that point, I was motivated to race the Vuelta. I felt the past few days my training had been going well, and the sensations were good. The numbers, I was hitting nice numbers in training, and I was actually starting to get motivated, thinking,
we'll see what something happens.
Something good. I've been in a situation before where you're sort of dead man walking, and then 2 weeks later you got the form of your life. So I thought, I'm just going to have to see how this goes. And then the days after that, I was starting to get more and more and more motivated. And
here we are. Nice one, mate. I like it. Really good to hear the backstory of that. Moving on through these quickly. On the bus, rev up music. This is from Lexo and Nicola. What are you listening to? Are you listening to a podcast? You listening to anything? What sort of music goes through your head? You got a good little music taste.
Yeah, a bit of a mixed bag for me. I'll go with anything, but I think we've got it right. We have our own playlist. Each rider at the start, this is Mitch's idea, each rider at the start of the World Tour, start of the Grand Tour, picks 10 of their favourite songs or 10 crowd pleasers, whatever. They got free reign. Pick any song they like, 10 songs, all goes into a hat on the playlist, and then we shuffle the playlist for the next 3 weeks. while we're getting changed or on the journey to the start, we stick around. And then it creates discussion as well, because on the first time we hear all the songs, the first kind of cycle of the playlist, a lot is they got a guess, who picked this one, and some guys play like, keep it a bit of a guessing game. They don't. Then we find out that it was you. And some of them are surprising. Some of them are quite easy to pick out. But then some songs you think, I did not expect that from him.
It is quite good, isn't it?
It's a good little sort of an icebreaker, is not the right expression, but
it's nice to learn about your teammates. You're like, I did not see that about you.
You forget about the race. You can get a bit heated. You're like, who the big this one? What were you thinking? This is a shocker of a song. Or you thought, I didn't know you like this music. It brings you together and separates you at the same time. Sometimes.
Next one here. What are you guys drinking during the Vuelta stage? What do you drink?
Mix.
That's scratch mix.
Yeah.
I have a Morton mix.
Yeah, well, we're quite fortunate. We have about 15 different drinks we can have.
Yeah.
But the Soigneurs come to us before the race starts and they make a list and say, okay, so what do you want to start with? Normally during the stage, it's less important. You know, you
get what you get.
You can get, if you're getting one from the side of the road, it's always a mix. It's always an important bottle to get, so it's always a mix. But at the start, some riders pick, Rigo, for example, likes one water, one mix on his bike at the start. I always go for one mix, which is standard carbohydrate drink, nothing carbohydrate with isotonic salts in it. Some riders like yourself, you say a Morton
which is
drink,
a high carbohydrate drink.
Very high carbohydrate drink. Some guys like one of those and one mix, or one Morton high carb drink and one water. It's your choice. You can choose, and the Soigneurs will prepare it for you.
Gels with caffeine or without? What flavour gel is your favourite? This is from Desmo.
Gels, okay. Caffeine gels, I'm not a big fan of. I don't really get into those. I don't know why. I just never have.
Do you have the Morton gels or the OTE gels?
I usually stick with the OTE gels. The Morton gels are good. I like them, but the flavours of the OTE gels are more... They can just give you a bit more of a...
What's your favourite?
For me, the apple flavour.
Nice.
Apple flavour or the lemon and lime. But they're all good. And to be honest, we said this before the other day, when you're in a race, it's in one line, you reach for a gel, you're on a climb, they all taste the same. You don't think, oh, this apple flavoured gel's nice when you're doing 450 watts hanging on for grim death.
You
know
slam
what I mean?
It down, you don't give two shits.
You think, that gel's going to help me out here. You don't think that apple gel or that blackcurrant gel was great.
How do you manage being top five in a Grand Tour? It's not something you're used to. How have you been managing it so far?
It's a first for me, but I think I'm managing it quite well. I think for me, I get better with less pressure, less stress, less pressure. Having a good team around me that's working for me and confident in me brings the best out of me. Some riders crumble under that. They think, I've got the weight of eight riders on my shoulders, or seven guys helping me on my shoulders, the staff on my shoulders, the directors on my shoulders. But for me, it gives me an extra push. I think, okay, I've got to perform. You know what I mean? Not in a bad, not in a pressure way, but like, I can't lose, but I can't, nothing can go wrong. You know what I mean? I've got a team. I don't have to waste any energy on silly things.
It's a positive
thing for me. And I don't think of it as, I've got so much to lose. I think every day that I keep in this position is less weight off my shoulders, you know what I mean? It's like the first day I did well, second day I did well, third day I did well, fourth day, everything. Every day I've done well, chipped away at the GC. I got knocked back a couple of places on one stage. I've gained a place yesterday, won the stage. So now after winning the stage, for me, it's almost job done.
Yeah,
it's not job done.
Anything from here is positive.
Yeah, anything. If it all goes pear shaped on tomorrow or the next days, then I've won a stage and I had 2 weeks in the top five. That's fantastic for me, and for any rider, that's still fantastic. So that attitude, I think, for me, is the best way to get the best out of myself. Having low stress, no real expectation. Not saying I'm going to win that stage. I have to finish top five on the stage, or it's a disaster. No, it's. If you have one bad day, it's one bad day. We'll see, we'll reassess. It's only a bike race, we'll reassess. And then go forward from there. Yeah, not counting down the day, going, it's 6 days to go, it's 5 days to go, 4 days to go. No, you think there's six opportunities left to gain more time. There's five opportunities to gain more time. or whatever. You know what I mean?
It's a great way of looking at it.
Got to be as positive as you can be.
Yeah, and even when you lost a bit of time here and there, you know, some guys might freak out and, oh no, I lost 10 seconds. And it's like, well, you know, I lost 10 seconds, but that's fine because I stayed safe. I could have broken my collarbone. Exactly. And this is where I'm here in the race.
Exactly. So,
all right, now moving away a little bit from the race now. Do you guys both ride gravel and do you use it for training or leisure?
Gravel, I'd say off-road for me because not exclusively gravel. But last year, no, but I have a cyclocross bike or a gravel. It's a cyclocross bike. I have it's a beautiful bike, Cannondale. Carbon, the works. It's a dream bike. It's got SRM power meter. Well, it's got a power meter on it. It's got
Schmicko
Durace hydraulic, yeah. Clutch mech, XTR clutch mech.
Righto.
Carbon wheels, tubeless. Yeah, yeah.
I get the idea. Dogs, yeah.
Or the mutts nuts, the polite version. It's a beautiful bike. And yeah, when I lived in Pamplona, I used to ride that. There used to be a big path the way from Pamplona. I don't know where on earth it ended, but it's this big, what you class as a big gravel path. It went up hill and down dale. It was up and down, steep little bits, technical bits on it. And the year that I got that bike in 2018, all winter I just rode on that. It never got boring, never got tiring. Mm. It went past through villages as well, so you could pull in, stop for a sandwich, stop for a coffee, fill your bottles up. It was
perfect.
It was perfect. You could get all your training done with the power meter and all this shit, all that stuff, and it was great.
I meant to say the last two questions were from CM and Josu, and the next question here from Max and Michael and Catherine. What do you guys think you'd be doing for a job if you weren't a pro cyclist? It's a common question, actually. What would you be doing?
I really don't know. It's a really difficult question that I'd rather not think about in a lot of ways. I would have liked to be in some kind of teaching job, I think. I think I'd be a good teacher. I think I wouldn't be sort of usual sort of teacher. I think I'd be good relation with the kids and good with the children and on a good level with people, being able to speak to a lot of people and sort of bring a different energy, I think.
Mm. What subject?
Any subject, I think. I don't know. I mean, sport, no, definitely not sport. But
geography?
I did quite like the teacher we had at high school, a geography teacher. He was a good bloke I got on. He was one of the ones. He was a teacher that I think I'd be quite like, you know what I mean? I'd get the best out of every student rather than just getting the best out of the conscientious ones, you know what I mean? Mm. But yeah, I think after my cycling career, I don't know what I'd do. It's impossible to say now. Mm. To be in a job where you can sort of make a difference in people's lives, I'm not talking about, you know, like charity work, things like that, but like in like a more sort of mainstream way where you can like teach people or, yeah, something that is totally nothing to do with me, you know what I mean? Mm. But I'm not gaining anything from it. At the moment, my job, it's all about me, you know what I mean? I sleep and rest for me.
Be nice to do the opposite.
And people do stuff for me, like my family and people like that. It sounds terrible to say, but it's all about me. You know what I mean?
It's true, yeah.
It's a selfish period of our lives. And I want it to be a period of my life. You see some riders and they hang on to it, you know? They retire and they still can't let go of that number one mentality. And for me, I look forward to letting go of that. I look forward to helping people. I enjoy helping people. I enjoy being considerate and kind and things, and I think that's something I look forward to. Whether, I don't know, maybe I could apply that into the world of cycling. I don't know, maybe like a Swan Ewer or something. Maybe could be sort of that similar sort of attitude, where sort of like a selfless attitude. I don't know, I'd like to be more selfless in the future.
Nice.
Sort of kind of flip the coin almost.
I like it. I think the initial period of that might be tough. But once you eventually move into it, you'd be like, yeah, this is exactly what I want.
Yeah.
From Matt and Ben and Sean, favourite UK climb, favourite Preston climb. Favourite, and on the back of this, favourite ride around Lancashire and coffee stop. Give us all your favourites.
Okay, so favourite climb in the UK and favourite climb in my area, probably the same climb, probably a climb called Birdie Brow. It's between Clitheroe and sort of in the middle between a town called Clitheroe and a town called Preston, and it's steep. I mean, it was like the length of the climb is like that easy section where I put it in the big ring on yesterday on the angler, you know what I mean?
Oh yeah, that flat bit. 10%.
But in the local areas, it's a sort of a fear climb. No one, on the Strava things, you go on other people, other climbs and stuff, and they'll have loads of people climbing them every day and day out. But Burry Brow is sort of,
how long is it?
There's another climb called Chagley Brow that sort of, you get to almost the same place, but it's an easier sort of calmer climb. Oh, the length is like a 6 minute climb. It might be, if I go full gas, 5 or 6 minutes, I think. I can't remember the record. But yeah, that's my favourite climb because no one used to climb it. So for me, I think, oh, I'm getting an advantage by climbing it. So if this is the climb that everyone fears, and I do it regularly.
What's your favourite ride around there?
Probably up into the Trough of Bowland, up around that way. Similar sort of neck of the woods. Trough of Bowland, up around there. That's for me. You never get tired on a good day. About raining, windy, sunny, it's the same for me.
Good coffee out there. Where do you stop for coffee?
The best place for me, well, a pot of tea for me. When I'm out on the bike, I would have a pot of tea. I think we discussed this before last year. Just for me, it quenches the thirst better. Do you know what I mean? Coffee in the UK, no disrespect, but a lot of places, unless you go to a special sort of specific coffee shop, the coffee can be a bit crap. So I think you can't f*** a pot of tea. So I always go for a pot of tea in the UK. But the place I go to is in Scorton, a little village, probably 10-15 miles from Preston. I think it's about 12 miles from Preston. Scorton, and it's called the Apple Store Cafe.
Shout out!
Free pots of tea if you're listening.
Use the code Hugh Carfee.
Yeah, for your 10% in the description below. Hit the subscribe button and the bell icon. No, it's called the Apple Store Cafe, and it's like it's set in this. You have to climb up a little hill to get there, and you go on this little dirt path to get like the car park's a little dirt path. It's not long, about 50 meters long, and you kind of wind into it. And it's in the grounds of an old stately home, and you sit in like the sort of. Oh, they're not conservatory. What do you call them? Like the kind of plantation areas, sort of like they've converted them into like they've got like roaring wood burning stoves in there and stuff. And it's really old school.
Sounds good.
It's old school. Yeah, it's
rustic.
Sort of rusty. Big pots of tea and fresh cakes, scones, cakes, bacon sandwiches, the works. You know what I mean?
Perfect. All right, we've got a couple last questions here. Do you enjoy some butter pies on your day off still?
When I'm back in the UK, I'm back in Preston, always butter pies. And
what is a butter pie?
It's a pie that...
Full of butter?
No, it's a Preston. It's a sort of Preston, local to Preston. I think Preston and surrounding areas, I think. Basically, it's a potato and onion pie. It's the old school vegan, vegetarian, not vegan, but vegetarian option, you know what I mean? But it's not. It's still up there, ranked up there.
Why is it called a butter pie?
I think because when you cut it open, I have no idea why they call it butter pie. It's not because it's full of butter. It's just, I think maybe when you cut it open, because it's quite pale inside, or maybe people think, oh, it looks like, I don't know. But it's got potato and onion, and that's it inside.
Sounds like a pasty.
No, a pasty just different to a pie. I'm not getting into an argument about pies and pasties. But it's just, it is what it is. It's local. But if you speak to someone from say, Lancaster, which is 20 miles up the motorway, or 32k up the motorway, whoever's listening, you say, can I have a butter pie? They'll say, what? What are you on about? You go 20 miles down the motorway from Preston, can I have a butter pie? Like, what are you on about? But in Preston, they have a butter pie, everyone knows what a butter pie is. But I go, we always go to, it's a place my mum's been going there, it's around the corner from where my mum used to live, a pie shop, well, it's a bakery, they sell all sorts of confectionery and stuff. It's been going for donkey's years. Gornell's Pies on Newall Lane, if anyone's listening from Preston, go in there. You got to get there early because a lot of the workmen and the tradesmen.
Just shout out 10% off Hugh Carfee code.
Another shout out, yeah. Gornell's Pies, you won't miss it. Big green sign over the window, and it's a great little shop. Meat and potato pies is a classic. I think it'd be a tough call between a meat and potato and the steak ones. The meat and potato, which is like the classic. Then they have the steak pies, which are slightly different. Normally they're round. The meat and potato and butter pies are round. The steak ones are sort of like rectangular shape, with like a rich dark gravy with steak, bits of steak in it. Meat and potato, obviously, sort of chunks of potato and whatever. The butter pie is the potato and the onion pie, and then they have all the cakes are good as well. And on they have a menu, they do soup as well. They have a big like big urn for the soup. And on days of the week, so they have the Monday deal, Tuesday deal, Wednesday deal for whatever the weekday deal. And that Monday will be like pie and peas, pie, peas and gravy. So a pie in like a little polystyrene tub. You have the pie, a few peas on the side, and gravy. One day it'll be like pie and beans or something. So butter pie and beans, I think, is classic. So butter pie and then baked beans in the tray. The Wednesday will be like, I don't know, I can't remember. I've
it sounds like you're pretty known pretty well there.
I'll do like a pie. Then, yeah, Wednesday will be something else, like pasty and chips or something. Thursday will be something else, and Friday will be something else. And you go there at lunchtime and dinner time is what we call it in the north of England. Dinner is lunchtime, and we call our dinner in the evening tea. So it's breakfast, dinner, and tea. So if you go there at dinner time, it's full of workmen, yellow jackets, plastic hard hats on, all queuing up outside to get the, not in COVID times, but in normal times, they're all queuing up, getting the pie, peas and gravy, or the they do sandwiches as well. They do like fresh sandwiches, tuna mayo and egg salad, ham and cheese, BLT, all the rest. Oh, it's a great place.
Oh, geez, we've got the whole menu there. Brilliant. Yeah. All right, last question.
Well, they're paying me, I say. You gotta. No, they're not.
Well, I got two quick. There's two last quick questions. This is from Rob from Preston. Crumbly or cream Lancashire?
What does that mean? Cheese.
Right.
So there's two Lancashire's. UK in general, I defend UK a lot actually, but cheese is a big selling point of the UK. We do good cheese, and Lancashire especially. You got your cheddar and your Stilton and your Red Leicester, things like that. Your famous ones, but Lancashire's pretty up there with the cheese in the cheese world, in well the British cheese world. And there's two kinds of cheese. There's two types of main Lancashire cheese: Lancashire crumbly and Lancashire creamy. They're like a white cheese. They're quite mild cheese. They're not a mature strong cheese. I can't remember the brand of them. There's one brand that I can't remember. But my nana, I wouldn't say she loves buying cheese. The nice cheese. She'll push the boat out on cheese. She's not I'm saying she's a wealthy woman, nothing like that. But
when it comes to cheese,
no. But she's from an age where things like butter, she lived through a war and stuff, and things like butter and cheese back in those, they were like a real luxury item. You know, if you had butter on a once in a blue moon or some nice cheese, you had to really sort of savour it. So she goes to shop, and you go around to her house and you sort of rummage through the fridge looking for something, and there was like huge block of Lancashire creamy cheese. So you're like, she's not watching, so you do like open the plastic Tupperware and cut a big slab.
Does she notice?
She wants us to. She loves it. But yeah, so for us, it's always creamy.
Creamy.
But that said, cream, if you're just eating it like a pig, just chopping slabs off and eating it creamy, it's sort of difficult because it goes both ways. On a sandwich, crumbly is good, even despite it makes a real mess when you're eating it.
Yeah.
My parents, when we went to school, my parents used to buy us, we used to make sandwiches with like this Warburton's seeded batch or something, and it was like a whole grain bread with these seeds and stuff, and the bread itself was crumbly. Then they used to put
crumbly cheese,
and then have you heard of Branston pickle?
No.
It's like a, look it up, it's like a dark pickle with like chunks of carrot and onion and stuff in it, a real dark pickle, with that thrown in as well to kind of slop it up a bit. So you open your sandwich, you open your cling film, and like you're sort of bracing for it crumbling before you'd even start eating it. But that said, the crumbly cheese on a sandwich, I think, is better.
You're not selling it. Yeah, right. Okay.
It's good. But it's great cheese. The next time I come back, I'll try and. If you're in Girona in the winter, I'll try and get you some vac packed and sent over to you, because it's great cheese. It's fantastic cheese.
Last question from Tom: when will you take the KOM back on the birdie brow?
Well, I had it under a secret account. I did it. I don't even have the login details for that account, so I'd probably have to make a new account to set up. I've been logged out, and I don't know the passwords. I can't remember the password stuff. So that's gone now. But I can't remember. I think Ian Bibby's got it. He's a local. You heard that name, Ian Bibby? He used to be a decent rider.
I haven't heard of him, no. Sorry.
I think you might have heard of him. I think he's got the record now. But he broke it by quite a way, but there's a bit of controversy because I got the record on the Strava under my secret account. Then a few people flagged it. But
so are you going to go back and take it this winter?
I don't know, because when they do it, they'll do it on race setup. When I do it, I go back with a training bike.
Yeah. You could still do it, though. In Angrelou form.
In Angrelou form. Yeah, I can't be bothered. Whenever I go back to the UK now, usually I'm sort of holiday mode.
Yeah.
It's either mid-season break or end of season break or Christmas, and I can't be going 6 minutes long burden, you know what I mean? Who can be with that in December?
Well, there we go, guys. It's time for us to actually do some training. It's on our rest day. Hugh's been kind enough to sit with me for an hour or more. Mate, thanks a lot, and I'm looking forward to the last week.
Thank you. Thanks for everyone.
Cheers.
Well, Mitch, over the first couple of weeks of this Vuelta, we've seen Hugh Carthy become a team leader for your team, EF Pro Cycling, and I'm wondering what he's like to work with or work for. I don't really know how that dynamic works when, you know, I mean, he's obviously a gifted climber. We already knew that, but here he is in contention at the right at the top end of GC, and I guess that, you know, can change the way that that riders are around one another. I don't know. You tell me.
It's a very individual thing, and different guys take it on different ways, as you can imagine in all types of jobs as well. You know, some guys lead by they're very loud and you know about, and other guys lead by example. And I get the feeling in this race, Hugh's really finding his feet. He's very much so leading by example. When he says something, he's showing it. He's backing it up with his legs. And off the bike, he's finding his feet there too. And he's actually been, I really respect it. He's just been a real leader and he's said what he wanted. I want to ride up the front. I want to ride in, you know, fourth in GC or second in GC, where we were. Let's fight for that position, and very vocal about it. And I love that. I love that he's grabbed it with both hands. And then secondly, he's been able to back it up with his legs. So, and me as a teammate and even the young guys in our team, when they hear this coming from his mouth, but then they see him do it with his legs, that is the best way you can be as a leader. So I think it's just been a beautiful progression over the last few years. I've seen been riding with him. When I first rode with him at the Giro, he was that guy trying to get in breaks. You know, last year he won that amazing stage in the Tour of Suisse, and this year he's sort of blossomed into this rider that we see, I think, for the future. And with this leadership, understanding that, understanding being in a GC role for 3 weeks, that's what this Vuelta is really all about. Aside from the results, what comes out of this, I think, is this new position as a leader. And I see him taking on really, really well, you know, 12 days in, and it's been a great experience for him, for me, watching it from the outside. So I think it's been a great experience.
Do you think it helps, you know, when a rider has kind of done his time as a helper as well? I mean, Hugh Carthy must have, over the years he's been racing in Grand Tours, he will have done his share of pacing people back or, you know, getting bottles and doing the teamwork. So he kind of knows what it is that he's asking others to do for him now.
I think that is a big element of it. And I also think a big element of it is his time he spent in a Spanish team in Caja Rural before he came to this team. He learnt the ropes there, the European way. He speaks the language, speaks Spanish. He's got friends outside of his normal friendship group in terms of English speakers and our team. So he's immersed in the cycling culture. He understands the old times. He understands the elements of cycling respect, you know, the different pedigrees of the riders. And I think that is a massive part of cycling, you know, the tradition that is very much getting lost in the more recent years. And I think to become a true leader in the teams, you need to understand all elements of everyone's position in the team, doing the roles yourself, but also the history of the sport. And that's something that he loves. And I really do see that in him. And in just the conversations we have at the dinner table, you can relate to him in all types of levels, modern day cycling and old cycling. So that's another great element of him as well.
And just lastly, I'm thinking back to last year's Vuelta where, you know, the team had quite a lot of of bad luck in the first two thirds of the race, and then he really had to kind of reset, and it all came good with the stage that Sergio Higuita won, didn't it? And I just wonder what's the contrast, you know, this year? Does it feel different? Do you all have more of a spring in your step because you know you're getting up for the last week of the race and you're right there banging contention?
Definitely, yeah. I think it was that first win of Mike's really just sort of broke that bubble. You know, we came in with Danny Martinez was going to be our GC hope. Hugh was his first chance at GC, but we weren't too sure. And then Mike got that stage win, and then suddenly the pressure was off. And as we saw, Hugh just kept going forward, and the rest of us were happy to support him. You know, and yesterday was a massive thing too. The Angrelou, Hugh being on GC, being able to ride away from the best riders, and now it's just like, let's just see what happens this last week. It's not like, you know, last year where we're just holding things together and hoping for some kind of result. That was a completely different scenario. Now we're just sort of happy to see what happens, and really got a big fight there as well, and sort of a happy fight, if you know what I mean. Like, let's push for it. Let's see what we can get out of this, because we've achieved so much already, and let's just see what we can do from here. So I think that's an amazing way to approach the last week, and I'm trying to stay on that side of things and not get too worried about the mountains coming ahead.
And just lastly, I mean, obviously he won on the Angleroo yesterday. I mean, that is a really, really tough climb. I can't think of any tougher. And maybe Zonkalan in the Giro is, you know, in the same bracket. But I'm always fascinated by this, and I'm sure I've asked you this before in different races, but at what point did you know that Hugh Carthy had won the stage? Did you get a message over the radio, or were you out of range, or were you sort of climbing up wondering what was going on up front?
It was very similar to a couple of years ago when Mike Woods won a stage in the Basque Country. It was a steep climb and I was dropped, and I listened to the whole commentary on the radio. It was in English then, obviously, because Mike speaks English. This time it was in Spanish because Hugh speaks Spanish and our director Juanma is Spanish. But I could just tell by the enthusiasm, and I picked up a few words here and there that he'd won. Sure enough, the team car that was following me decided to come up next to me on a, let's say, 20-25% grade, and wanted to have a whole conversation about the victory. And I was able to give him a thumbs up and a little smile, and I said, let's just chat about that in 20 or 30 minutes when I get over this thing.
Yeah, not really in the mood to chat at the moment.
No, exactly. It was great. And I'm really looking forward to finishing this for Welter. It is an element of the end of the year. I am feeling that. But I really want to get to the end of this race with a big success we've had so far. And also on a personal level, that it's been a long year and I really want to finish it on my own terms. But I do want to say to everyone out there, hang in for the next podcast. It's going to be the last podcast for us from Life in the Peloton. I've got a very special podcast, so I'm not going to reveal what that is. It's coming up in 2 weeks. The end of the season's here. So until then, guys, thanks a lot. You have been listening to Life in the Peloton. The producer of this episode was Will Jones. The music in this episode was composed by Pete Shelley. Thanks, mate.